This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the many problems plaguing the controversial legal case of Silk Road. Founder Ross Ulbricht's mother joins us to detail preclusion of critical evidence in the courtroom, including two corrupt agents now in prison, that may have changed jurors' minds. Defense attorney Judy Ritter joins us to talk about how a recent Supreme Court decision may bring justice to several death row inmates in Pennsylvania. One of those cases involves Mumia Abu-Jamal. A new book, Anatomy of Innocence, Testimony of Wrongfully Convicted, details in gripping stories several people who have been exonerated.
America is one of the few countries in the world who still uses the death penalty. Here are some stories of people who might have been killed but for an innocence project.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In 2015, a jury found that then 30-year-old Ross Ulbricht had created and run an anonymous digital black market for drugs called Silk Road. The case was a high-profile one, and Ulbricht had come to be known by some as the face of the dark web. He was convicted on 7 charges, including a kingpin charge, and Judge Catherine Forrest imposed 2 life sentences and 40 years without possibility of parole. Prosecutors had not even sought such a long sentence. In Ross's 2016 appeal, defense attorneys outlined a litany of improprieties and abuses in the investigation and trial. Perhaps most serious was that the court precluded information about 2 corrupt federal agents investigating Silk Road, who are now both serving prison sentences for corruption. The defense team maintains that Ulbricht's convictions should be vacated and a new trial ordered, or that he receive a retrial before a different judge. A new book by Nick Bilton called American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind Silk Road, presents what the Ulbricht family, his legal team and supporters, describe as a fictionalized version of the government's narrative of the case. It is said that in many instances, the author has relied on unproven and claims that were not charged at trial. We are delighted to be joined today by Ross's mother, Lynn Ulbricht. Lynn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Silk Road case is, I think, one of the most important cases to surface in the last several years. And while we haven't covered it extensively on Law and Disorder, I'd like to just give a brief overview for listeners who may not be aware of it. First, how much did you know about the Silk Road website before Ross was arrested in 2013?
Nothing. I'd never heard of it. I hadn't even heard of the dark net. I had heard of Bitcoin, barely, but not Silk Road.
And how did Ross explain what the site was about and his involvement, if at all?
No, Ross never discussed anything like that with me.
What was your reaction when he was arrested?
Complete shock and horror. At first, shock, because I didn't realize the extent. I just knew he'd been arrested, and I was like, Ross? He's never been in trouble. He's never had any problems with the law, certainly. And then all of a sudden, it was a media, tsunami, and I was trying to not drown in it. So my reaction, and ever since, I've been trying to frantically paddle fast enough to ride that wave. It's been quite the learning curve and, wild ride, really.
I'd like to talk a bit about the trial, and there's a lot of material here, so we'll summarize some of the highlights. The federal government has prevented a great deal of evidence at the trial level from being presented by the defense, and that included evidence relating to corrupt agents, precluding defense experts, as I understand it, keeping out certain exhibits. In a case, it's really about what for some are complex notions, as you allude to, the dark web, technology, bitcoins. You've said that the most frustrating thing is that evidence favorable to Ross was suppressed. Can you talk a bit about some of those examples?
Well, I think the most glaring is the corrupt agents who are now in prison. The defense fought this pre-trial. because they were informed of one of the agents. They were not informed of the second agent until after trial, even though the government knew about him. And that person, Sean Bridges, was working for the NSA at the time that he was investigating Silk Road. That came out later in his own court case, and Secret Service, and the defense didn't even know about him. But the defense protested in a pretrial hearing that the jury should know about a corrupt agent who had basically run of the site for a long time, and according to Ross's lawyer, had the ability to commandeer accounts, actually act as DPR, Dread Pirate Roberts, who they say Ross was exclusively. They could change passwords, PIN numbers, access bank accounts, which they did and stole money, and change chats, which were evidence, write chats, delete chats. They had what one journalist called the keys to the kingdom. And this was not permitted to be known to the jury. Their existence was not known to the jury. And the argument in the appeal is that this is a violation of the Brady Rule, for one thing. And the jury did not get the full picture. They were also given a very controlled narrative. And there's a lot of ways that is true. I don't know if we have time to go into all of them, but many things were kept from their knowledge.
Well, before we get into that, and we can cover it briefly, essentially what you're saying, if I understand this correctly, is that there were two agents that behind the scenes, and I assume unknown to Ross or others, were helping to run the website and thus controlling, as you say, chat rooms, material that might possibly be used to exonerate Ross in this case.
Well, to be clear, we don't know if Ross was even involved at that point. But they were at the core of the Maryland investigation. And Carl Force was DEA, and then Sean Bridges was NSA and Secret Service. And they infiltrated the site using several aliases. So I'm not clear how high their administrative – well, no, they had high administrative access. That's what the defense was outlining when they said they could do all those things. So I guess you could say they were helping run the site. It's in the appeal.
Right.
It's
interesting
discussed.
Because there's another unrelated case, but it also involves the dark net. And that is where it's called Operation Playpen, or it was.
Right. They got less of a sentence than Ross.
And what happened was the FBI commandeered that site and then ran it for a couple of weeks.
Kept it open.
And reports say they actually did much better. They had a lot more visitors when the FBI was running it. But this happened.
I think it was longer than a couple of weeks. I could be wrong. I don't know for sure.
Well,
they also did the same with Silk Road. They commandeered, they got the server and kept it open, despite Chuck Schumer publicly saying, we have to close it down immediately. And actually, they say that two people died of overdoses after they had control. So my question is, then why aren't they being held accountable? If it's this question of transferred intent, you know, who is our website hosts, are others responsible for the actions of other people?
Well, let's talk briefly. So Ross was ultimately convicted on 7 charges, including one called the so-called kingpin charge.
Right.
There were allegations of, as you've alluded to, murder.
Murder for hire.
There were no murders.
No murders ever occurred. Journalists do say murder because journalists are often very sloppy. It wasn't charged at trial at all.
But yet it's in the public narrative because when we hear Ross Ulbricht, when we hear Silk Road, we hear murder for hire.
Right. And then it morphs into murder, although show me the murder. But yeah. It was never charged at trial. There is an indictment sitting in Maryland now for 3.5 years or so that has never been prosecuted. The government basically has not brought forward these charges in any substantive way.
Lynn, just to clarify, we've referred to DPR or Dread Pirate Roberts and allegations of murder.
For hire,
exactly. Important distinction.
Yeah, that is, because there were no bodies. No one was murdered.
Right. So this could all be fabricated, but basically, so if listeners don't know, DPR was the handle. It's a name that comes out of the Princess Bride, but it was referring to one or more individuals who allegedly ran Silk Road, managed the website.
Correct.
And allegations were that in some of the chats, There were murder for hires directed at DPR, but nothing was ever proven by DPR. Nothing was ever proven.
No, it wasn't charged at trial. It was never been prosecuted. So, no, nothing's proven. And just as an aside, since trial, it's been discovered, and this came out in a press release by Ross's lawyer, that another person using the DPR handle logged into the Silk Road after Ross was in prison, which to me shows quite clearly that he was not the one and only Dread Pirate Roberts, and it's a big question.
Exactly. Now, let's, before we go on, I want to just clarify, there were so many prosecutorial and one could argue judicial overreaches and improprieties in this case. But one important issue related to the internet is that the search warrant used to get Ross's laptop, that was questionably gained, correct?
Yeah, that's an issue in the appeal as well, and it is joined by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, as well as EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, who agree that the warrants are unconstitutional because they're general warrants and lack the particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment. And it's a huge question for the digital age, because the government's argument is, well, we have a warrant for the laptop. But that's like saying we have a warrant for your house or we have a warrant for your file cabinet, physical file cabinet. And, of course, a laptop is a file cabinet on steroids. It has, you know, it's basically they're saying, well, too bad that the founding fathers didn't mention laptops. They just said papers. So digital material is not protected, and that we give up our right to privacy because we use computers and phones. And huge question for the digital age.
Huge question, and I think has been effectively clouded in terms of the public's perception and knowledge about this case, because those issues are integral as we talk about having a robust and free internet and privacy protections for individuals, which are increasingly imperiled at this moment in time.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to check with you, the case has been appealed with lawyer Josh Dreitel. Mm-hmm. That was several months ago. What's the status of the case? Is we just waiting to hear? There were oral arguments, and you're waiting to hear.
Yeah, there were oral arguments a little over 6 months ago. It was filed, let's say, a year ago, June, and we are waiting to hear. And we've been told, I have no idea if this will happen, but we've been told that the longer that the court takes indicates that they're deliberating hard on this and that they see the important precedents being set here. And, you know, I'm hopeful that Ross will get some relief from the appellate court in New York.
The judge in this case meted out an extraordinarily harsh sentence,
yes,
far more than what the prosecutors were seeking. She gave Ross two life sentences and said she wanted to make a lesson of him.
Plus 40 years. Don't forget those 40 years.
Two lives
she threw
plus
on
40.
There. And, well, she and the prosecutors said, because you used the internet in this way, you must be an example. You must be punished. Now, of course, since this case went to trial, there's been a proliferation of bigger sites. It didn't work as a deterrent at all. And also, she brought up Ross's political philosophy to justify her sentence, which in the reply, the appeal saying this is a First Amendment problem because we should not be penalized for our political views, which are basically libertarian free market views. I mean, they're not exactly radical. And she said, I'm not sure you've given up this philosophy. And so basically she's saying I need to put you in a cage for the rest of your life because I just don't know if you might come out and have that philosophy still. Now, this is very serious. This is a problem for all of us.
That's a huge statement. Yes. Mm-hmm. There's been a development since Ross's appeal, namely publication of a new book by Nick Bilton. It's called American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. What's your response to this new book?
Well, I haven't read the book. I have read excerpts and interviews with the author. And the main point, really, is that he bases a narrative that's fictionalized on uncharged, uncharged at trial, unproven allegations. And this is a problem. He assumes the government's narrative is correct. I was warned not to participate because of that. I was warned that that was what it was going to be, and sure enough, it is. So I think it's essentially at its foundation sensationalistic. I believe that the government couldn't charge Ross at trial, or they would have, and so Nick Bilton's doing it for him. He's appointed himself judge, jury, and executioner, and psychologist and mind reader with his fictionalizing that is absurd. I know some of the things personally that he said that were distorted and misleading. I've asked Ross about other things, and they're not important in terms of legally, but they just show a pattern of distortion and sensationalism that paints a very different picture from the truth. And so it may be rousing good fiction, but this is a man's life. He was very manipulative to try to get me involved, and I didn't only because I was warned that this is who he is.
Did he try to talk to Ross?
I don't believe he tried to talk to Ross. I don't know. I don't think so. Ross wouldn't have talked to him. What he doesn't talk to the media. He can't. He's been advised
not to, at this
stage.
What does the legal team think of how this might or may not impact on the chances for success in the appeal?
I've been told by various lawyers that judges don't read this kind of, basically, I would say garbage, but, you know, they don't read this, that they're not influenced by this, that it's not going to be an issue. PR people, of course, are worried. It's kind of old stuff. We've already dealt with this murder for hire allegation and put it to bed, generally speaking, because they didn't charge him at trial. And once that didn't happen and they dropped the charges in another point and they didn't charge him at trial for anything else and then haven't prosecuted the indictment, it's kind of like, why, guys? Of course, there's all this corruption that came out. And one of the corrupt agents was involved in the allegations. And so it starts to really not pass the smell test. But they can have someone like Nick Bilton, who has, as I assume, a career move in mind and, you know, an opportunity to, you know, taint the general perception once again.
Do you think, I know it's speculation, but private sources might have been involved in providing information of a certain narrative to Mr. Bilton?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was asked that by a reporter, a journalist who was reviewing the book, and he goes, he's very cagey about his sources. Was it all public? And actually, I was told by the same person who warned me properly that he knows that he and people he was associated with were given material from the government, I assume whitewashed, over a year before trial. I don't know if that's legal, and I can't prove it, and I'm not going to disclose my source. I mean, you know, but that's what I was told. So I personally think it's a very good possibility, especially considering the title, what he's doing. And it's really a very dutiful regurgitation of the government's narrative made entertaining.
Let's talk about Ross for a few minutes. How is he doing?
Yeah, I just saw Ross yesterday. He was part of a Toastmasters group in the prison, and he gave a talk on meditation because he's gotten so much out of it. He is, you know, look, it's a very stressful situation. He's been in that place, which the UN has actually called torture, and El Chapo's lawyers are protesting because of the terrible conditions, for 3.5 years. So it's a difficult place. It's very confined. He's a big outdoors guy. He gets outside on a roof, basically, not nearly enough. So it's tough. That said, Ross is a very strong individual. He's been helping other inmates a lot. He's helped many of them get their GED. He's helped 4 of them get into a remote college course that he basically acted as tutor for them. He's given a yoga class, physics class. He's generally very helpful. The Toastmaster people and also the Moth, he was part of that storytelling. They love him. In fact, the Toastmaster woman just said, oh, you know, I'd love to have Ross take part in teaching this a part of this, about meditation, since he had talked on it, things like that. He's trying to be and is just naturally a positive person. And he's really, you know, it's a very, you know, to be given a life sentence. And he's a all his convictions are nonviolent. Not one victim came forward at trial and said Ross had harmed them. He has no history of violence. He is no threat to anyone.
What do you think, why do you think he represents such a threat to the government that they would want to charge him thus or sentence him so?
I suspect that Bitcoin, which is the cryptocurrency exclusively used on the Silk Road, now it's very mainstream almost, but at the time it was very shocking. And Chuck Schumer, who was behind the case and the investigation and calling for the shutdown, was on the Senate Finance Committee, as well as, I believe, the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee or something like that. Don't hold me to that title. And I think that the financial powers were very concerned about a currency that was outside of their control. That's my personal feeling. Also, Tor and the ability to be private on the Internet, the government even said in their motion, or maybe it wasn't a motion, but it was some kind of official reply or something at the beginning, anyone who uses Tor has criminal intent. So this is in writing. That's what they believe, and I believe they see it as a threat. I also personally believe that they want to control the Internet.
I think you're right.
And so they said, in the judge and the prosecution said, you use the Internet in this way, and you're going to have to basically hang from the highest tree for that and be an example, like the head on the medieval spike. You know, hey, that'll happen to you. And I don't think there's a law about being the first that I know about, but I've asked lawyers and they're like, no, not really. And so that's why I think it's not about drugs. And the reason I'm clear on that is because the other defendants who were drug convicted for selling drugs, the biggest drug dealer on Silk Road was convicted of 10 years. The biggest cocaine and heroin dealer got 5. One of the biggest meth dealers, if not the biggest, got 3 recently. And the guy who was running Silk Road 2.0, he got 8. A high-level admin during the height of Silk Road got 17 months. He's out. Time served. The agents got 6 and 7. So they could easily have been selling drugs. I don't think it's about drugs. I think that proves it's about a platform and not a product.
I think it's also about an individual who demonstrated creativity, resourcefulness, and was highly successful. And the government usually goes after that kind of so-called leader. We've seen that on the streets in protest movements. We call the web, you know, the electronic frontier. And Ross did very well in that respect in terms of producing something that was highly popular, used, and also, in my opinion, took out a lot of the danger from drug-related transactions. And that must be a huge threat to the government.
Yeah, well, I think the government benefits a whole lot from the drug war.
And this provided an alternative that was safer. And you have...
I doubt the cartels liked it a whole lot either.
This case and what's happened to Ross has exacted a huge toll on you personally, and you've been such a staunch advocate on his behalf. How are you doing?
Oh, thanks. I'm very tired. I could use a vacation, to be honest. However, I see myself as his advocate, but as well, I see what's happening in the government and in losing our freedoms. And so I see it as a bigger fight as well. I really do. In addition, I've gotten to know people at the prison and who are victims of the drug war as well. And I see myself as their advocate. They can't speak out as well as I can. They don't have a high profile case. They don't. And there are thousands of people, multiple thousands, who are being basically put in cages in our country. Over 60% are nonviolent drug offenders that are cramming our prisons. And this is a whole, we could go off on that for another hour. But so I think it's very important, not just for Ross. And I do believe in Ross, and I am committed to getting him out of there eventually, because he shouldn't be in there, you know. But there's a lot of people who shouldn't be in there. And so that keeps me going. But I'm doing all right. I have a lot of wonderful support. It's hard to fight big media like this book and like many journalists and many people. It's very hard. And it's hard to fight big government.
It is daunting.
And they're kind of, I wonder how much, they're kind of the same. And right. It is daunting. But people need to wake up. I think it needs to be grassroots. And I think people are waking up.
Lynn, how can our listeners learn more about this case and get involved if they want to help?
Thank you for asking. Well, freeross.org is our hub. You can find out pretty much everything there. You can communicate with me. I'm behind. I have this big, long list. One of them is I want to do a fake news document about Ross, and not just this book, although this book is great material for that, but other things that have been said about the case and Silk Road that are just blatant. Like, for instance, there was no child pornography on Silk Road. It wasn't allowed, but I read it all the time. Or the idea of being charged with murder. Oh, wasn't he charged with murder? No, there wasn't even, he wasn't charged, at trial. And B, there was, that's kind of distortion. I've heard journalists
say. We need
say.
To set the facts straight.
Yeah, and so I just want to do that. I haven't done it, but I want to, but there's a huge, there's a very big page about the case if you want to get into it. We're revamping it, but basically that's the place to go.
And what's the URL for the website?
Freeross.org.
Freeross.org. We'll put a link to that on our website.
Oh, thank you.
And we want to stay in touch with you, Lynn,
as
things continue and try to get more visibility for this important case. And to thank you for everything that you've done and to really send our heartfelt good wishes to Ross.
I'll give it to him. I'm going to see him shortly.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In 2016, the United States Supreme Court in Williams v. Pennsylvania held that a prosecutor involved in seeking the death penalty should recuse himself if asked to judge an appeal in the capital case. 2 months after that decision, Mumia Abu-Jamal filed an appeal, calling into direct question the validity of his own criminal conviction and the denial of his appeals. Ronald Castile, the same prosecutor in the Williams case, had been a senior district attorney while Mumia's case was being tried. He was also the district attorney of Philadelphia during Mumia's direct appeals. While serving on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Castile rejected a recusal motion filed by Mumia's defense team. On this April 24th, Mumia's 63rd birthday, his lawyers were back in court, arguing that a motion for discovery should be granted to determine the particulars of Castile's personal involvement in Mumia's prosecution and appeals. Judge Leon Tucker ruled in favor of Mumia's demand for discovery and for the DA's files. The records must be turned over to Mumia's attorneys by May 30th, 2017. Here to discuss this break in Mumia's case is his attorney, Judy Ritter. Judy is professor of law and director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at Widener's Delaware Law School campus. She argued in 2011 before the Third Circuit that the instructions given to the sentencing jurors in Mumia's trial case were unconstitutional. That so-called Mills claim argument succeeded, and Mumia, as our listeners know, no longer faces a sentence of death. Judy Ritter, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here.
Judy, when the Supreme Court decided the case, Williams versus Pennsylvania, were you hopeful that Mumia Abu-Jamal and others in Pennsylvania might have a chance to have their cases reheard?
Yes. Immediately, we realized that there was an opening for our case, Mumia's case, to get back into court because he was in a very similar situation that Terry Williams was in with regard to the failure for a Supreme Court justice to recuse himself when he had the potential for being biased.
Judy, roughly how many cases are we talking about in Pennsylvania?
Between 15 and 20 cases, and all of the petitions were filed on behalf of all of these people, and they were actually all scheduled on the same day for a hearing on April 24th. We've gotten rulings on most of them, And they're really promising with regard to having people who are either on death row or serving life having some reconsideration of their appeals.
And basically, this case involves a prosecutor being involved in seeking capital punishment, the death penalty, and not recusing himself if asked to judge an appeal in the capital case.
That's right. So someone named Ron Castile was an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia for several years. He then left to run for mayor. He went back, though, as the he didn't succeed in his bid to be mayor. He went back to the DA's office as the elected chief DA for the city of Philadelphia. And in that role, he approved seeking the death penalty for many defendants. He was also there, Mumi Abu-Jamal, who's my client, he was the head DA during his direct appeals of his case. And then a few years later, he was elected to the state Supreme Court, where he sat for many years until he retired last year. And he wouldn't recuse himself for these cases where he had had an important role during their prosecution.
I'm curious, was Williams v. PA the first instance in which someone challenged what seems to me like a pretty large conflict of interest?
Right. No, it wasn't. Many of these defendants challenged the fact that Justice Castile didn't recuse himself. The first challenge, though, was to ask him to recuse himself. And the way it works in Pennsylvania and many other places, it's up to the judge being asked to recuse himself to decide whether or not he or she should be recused. They get to decide it. And what Justice Castile said in all the cases was, I was the chief. I couldn't possibly be on top of every single case. We had hundreds. So I didn't have a significant involvement, and I can be fair and unbiased. Those were appealed, but they were never, the appeals of the failure to recuse were never won, even in a federal court. And so there were challenges, but this is the first case where the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to review it. And, you know, they don't take many cases, so it was really surprising, but, you know, a great development when they took the Williams case.
And I remember when I was at Temple Law School in Philadelphia, reading about cases that Ron Castile, his name seemed to be everywhere. What are his views on the death penalty?
Well, he, as a prosecutor, he sought the death penalty in lots and lots of cases. And as a judge, and this is really important, and as a judge on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, he made his views pretty known that he was frustrated that the executions weren't happening, that the challenges were being brought by the federal defender, and he thought they had no business, you know, butting into the state court's cases, and he was really frustrated that the death penalty that was on the books in Pennsylvania wasn't, you know, really bringing execution. So that was pretty well known.
Hmm. Now, take us, if you will, into the courtroom on April 24th, when Mumia and others' cases were being heard. How did you feel as you were going in? Were you optimistic?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that when I got to the courthouse, I saw a rally for Mumia outside, really well attended, you know, which says
great.
A lot given how long this case has been, the struggle for Mumia has been going on. Nevertheless, it was a very, you know, nice-sized crowd outside. Upstairs in the courtroom, there was not one seat available because of Mumia's supporters sitting in the courtroom as spectators. So that was great. You know, we were skeptical about whether we would get any kind of relief because the DA's office very vigorously opposed our motion for a new appeal. What happened was Judge Tucker, who has never heard any of Mumia's claims in the past, was given all of these cases. He took Mumia's case first. Frankly, I think it's because he and his clerk wanted the crowd in the courtroom to leave. And he figured, let's get this done first. My co-counsel, Christina Swarns from LDF, made the argument. And Judge Tucker was really interested in all aspects of it. He really was. I mean, he asked a lot of questions about what information we thought we would get from discovery. So what happened in our case is that he granted our request for discovery. So it's a partial win, and the case would go on after we received discovery to give us a chance to show that Judge Castile had a lot to do with Mumia's case while he was a DA. He wasn't the DA during Mumia's trial, and the DA made so much of it, but we maintain that when he was the DA during Mumia's direct appeals, that because this was the highest profile case that that office really had ever had, that he had to have had a hand in it. He had to have been overseeing it. He had to have been interested in supervising it. And so this gives us the opportunity to get memoranda from the DA's office, notes, any kind of reports, press releases, try to show that he really did have this significant role in the case. Some of the other defendants, though, whose cases were argued, have actually been granted new appeals, because in those cases they've been able to show that he actually authorized seeking the death penalty. And that was the case in Williams. But Williams' case is not limited to when Judge Castile had authorize the death penalty. It's not limited to that. That just happened to be what the case was with Terry Williams. So we're hoping to show that there was a different type of significant role of Justice Castile in Mumia's appeals.
Now, Judy, how many boxes of materials do you expect to be turned over?
Well, let me just say that before we get any boxes or even pieces of paper, I suspect they're going to appeal this order.
Right.
And that is going to, delay, mm-hmm. for sure, getting anything. Even if we ultimately win that appeal, it's going to delay everything. If they do comply, I don't know what to expect. They could turn around and say, we have nothing.
Right.
They might very well say that. And so we'll see. The order is at this point limited to the receiving of documents as opposed to taking testimony.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll have to take it one step at a time. But I expect an appeal, not just in Mumia's case, but in all of these cases.
Are the documents going to be redacted?
It might be. The point is that, this is the kind of case where it's not like we're looking for so many little specifics as much as his involvement. So the fact that he was in a meeting where they discussed Mumia's appeal, the fact that he issued a press release about how hard they were going to defend the conviction, it's not like you need to necessarily have all the details. If there's, strategy in there that they redact, it shouldn't really be a problem, as long as we can show that he was at the table, whether it's literally at a table or, and memoranda, that we feel certain that he couldn't have been, on the outside totally and not informed about the progress of Mumia's appeal.
Especially because it was such a high profile and remains such a high profile case.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess just a sort of variant on that question is, do you see there being sort of a bright line at which you can establish with certainty involvement? Does it have to be a certain level of involvement that you need to prove?
It's hard to say. I should say that on that Justice Castile's name, signature, or signature block, is on all of the DA's office's appeals. So we have that already. The Supreme Court's decision in Williams is not specific in that way. It just says significant personal role. And they then define it a little bit as input as well. So we also know that Justice Castile, when he was running for the Supreme Court, bragged about his part and how the DA's office, handled some very celebrated death penalty cases. And, of course, Mumia's case was one of the most celebrated. And he bragged about how they were successful in, getting convictions and having them hold. I feel like we've already made a case, to tell you the truth, that he had this significant impact, a significant role. And I don't think it should take very much more to convince the court that we deserve to have his appeal of his post-conviction actions, and there's several of them, reheard, redone.
If you are granted that, what kind of challenges does the defense face in terms of witnesses, or is, because it's not a trial level, does that not apply?
Yeah, it will apply if we get a new trial, which of course is the ultimate goal here.
Right.
But in the interim, having the post-conviction, we lost in post-conviction. We lost four post-conviction actions. And they were all appealed to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania and all denied. So those appeals should all be reheard. They involve dozens of claims, from ineffective assistance of counsel to witness intimidation to race discrimination in jury selection to appealing to, you know, racism in arguments and in evidence put on by the prosecution to, you know, unreliable ballistics evidence, all sorts of things. And so the re-argument, it's really a re-argument of those issues, and that they should have been winning issues when the case was heard in a post-hearing hearing. So it's not a question of needing witnesses just now. It's really just a question of a fair Pennsylvania Supreme Court re-deciding those appeals. And not only Justice Castile wouldn't be permitted, of course, to sit if we got this relief. He's not even on the court anymore. But the court is different. You know, there are different justices on this Pennsylvania Supreme Court, so there's certainly reason to think that the result could be different. And so that's what it would be right now. But ultimately, of course, we should win those issues, and he should get a new trial.
In our few remaining minutes, I would be remiss if I didn't note that Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams has recently been indicted on federal corruption charges.
He hasn't. In fact, yesterday they added charges to the indictment.
Yeah, how is that affecting the legal community?
Oh, it's affecting, you know, I can only imagine what the people in his office are feeling and thinking, but there's been a lawsuit brought to, you know, get him to resign, even though legally he doesn't have to until he's convicted. It's unbelievable, really, that the chief prosecutor of the city of Philadelphia, you know, which carries on many prosecutions, is going to be on trial for serious crimes in the federal court soon. You know, the judge in that case wouldn't even, you know, grant a long postponement, and that he's still the head of the office. It's appalling, actually.
Remarkable indeed.
It is.
Judy Ritter, you are one of our heroes, especially for prevailing on the Mills claim several years ago in Mumia's case, and for continuing to be such a critical part of his defense team, along with Christina Swarns of NAACP-LDF. It's just so wonderful to have you on the show, and we hope to stay in touch over what we think may be some exciting developments in the next few years.
Well, I'll be happy to keep you updated, and it's really great to talk to you, Heidi, as always.
Capital punishment has made news headlines over the past few months as the state of Arkansas rushed to execute 8 men in a span of several days. For many years, the issue of state-sanctioned killings has not received much attention. News of exonerations of innocent men and women are rare. A new book, Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongly Convicted, presents the true stories of 15 exonerees, wrongfully convicted and then thrown into the complex criminal justice system before being among the very few to be exonerated. Edited by Leslie Klinger and Laura Caldwell, the book is unusual in that each exoneree is paired with a high-profile mystery and thriller writer, including Lee Child, Sarah Paretsky, Laurie King, Brad Parks, and others, to present their narratives. Barry Sheck of the Innocence Project and author Scott Turow also provide commentary. The book includes a letter from playwright Arthur Miller, believed to be the first and only unpublished piece since his death. Kirkus Reviews has called the compilation, quote, a unique collection of 15 wrongful conviction sagas bound to shake faith in the American criminal justice system. Joining us today is Leslie Klinger, widely considered to be one of the world's foremost authorities on Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, H.P. Lovecraft, and 19th century genre fiction. Welcome, Les, to Law and Disorder.
I'm delighted to be on the show. Thanks.
We're thrilled to have you. Tell us, was it your interest and expertise in detectives that led you to become involved in this book project?
Well, I'd like to claim that it was, but it wasn't. It was my expertise in doing books. Laura Caldwell and I have been friends for about 12 years or so, and we originally met through Sherlock Holmes, but I had been helping a little with the Life After Innocence project that she put together, and I knew of her work. I read her book, Long Way Home, in manuscript and so on. But when she conceived the idea for this book, she asked me to co-edit it with her. And I said at one point, "So why did you ask me?" And she said, "Well, you get stuff done, Les." So it was really for my editing skills and so on, I think, that I got involved. But it's just been an honor to be involved. Laura is really the heart and soul of this book, but it turned out to be a fair amount of work as well. Heart and soul don't get a book published.
How did this particular collection of 30 individuals, both writers and exonerees, come together?
Well, Laura and I both had been asked, Laura especially, a number of times by writer friends, how can we help? And she conceived this idea of pairing exonerees with some of our friends to tell their stories, because the story writers, first of all, they know the milieu. I mean, they certainly know the justice system. And second, they're masters of compression and of trying to find the dramatic moments in the stories. We knew that it wasn't going to be possible to tell the complete story of multiple exonerees because the stories are very complicated. There's many, many details. What we decided to do instead was to try and present kind of a composite picture of the, if you can call it, typical experience of an exoneree from the beginning, the arrest, all the way up through struggling to find inside yourself the reentry into society and adjusting to freedom again. And so each of the chapters is a different step along the way. We wanted to give the reader the experience of being in the skin of the typical exoneree and feeling what they felt along the way. So Laura has worked with many of the people who are in the book. Some she knew through the Innocence Network. Spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out which exonerees would work best with which individuals, writers, and then introduced them, gave them some dossiers with background, and then let them go to work.
I'm curious, how much did you know about how capital punishment is administered in this country before the project, and what, if anything, did you learn while co-editing it?
Well, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I mean, so I certainly had some awareness of this. Both Laura and I are lawyers, and tried to pay attention to the causes. I've always been a liberal lawyer, I suppose. I went to school at Bolt, and in my day when I was on the Law Review, we did a massive, massive issue on the death penalty. So I was certainly very familiar with the constitutional issues, the practical issues, et cetera, of the death penalty. But when you look at the problem of innocence and the staggering statistics, I mean, the studies now suggest as many as 5 to 10% of the prison population may be in fact innocent, factually innocent. It's got to say to you, we can't afford a death penalty in this country. We can't, as Arthur Miller's brilliant essay points out, the death penalty can't be dependent on luck. And it was just luck that got Peter Riley exonerated in the case that Miller wrote about. The facts of that case are that he was accused and convicted of raping and murdering his own mother. He was 17 years old at the time, I believe. And only when the prosecutor died after he'd been convicted and was waiting for the death penalty did they find exculpatory evidence in the files of the prosecutor when the new prosecutor took over the office. They found evidence that a a state trooper and his wife had actually seen Riley far across town, distant from where the crime had supposed to be committed, and clearly he couldn't have done it. But it was sheer luck that saved him from the death penalty. Mm-hmm.
You know, Les, Jim Lafferty here, one of the things that, of course, is happening in the country, happily, is that more and more death penalties are being removed from the statute books of states. More and more people are opposed to the death penalty and so forth and so on. That's great news as far as I'm concerned. But one of the thoughts that I've had as I've thought about these various innocent projects around the country is to what extent, if and when, and I think it's just a matter of some time now, when we finally find ourselves where there is no death penalty, no capital punishment in the country, is that going to take a little bit of the passion? I wonder.
Well,
what do you think? Is it going to take some of the passion out of the innocence work because it isn't then a matter of life and death?
Well, I mean, I hope if people read the book, they will not lose that passion because you will read about the tragedies of people who have had large chunks of their lives removed without cause. I mean, these people have suffered horribly. I mean, imagine. So the statistics show that 10% of the exonerees, and there's a national registry of exonerations at this point. There's about 2,000 exonerees in the registry, which is, of course, just the tiny tip of the iceberg. But of those 2,000 people, under 10% were, 10% were under 18 when they were arrested. Hmm. Fully half were 25 or younger. The sort of the average sentence of the people who have been exonerated is probably 15 to 20 years. So these are young people who have lost the years in which they could have been building a family, they could have been building a career, they could have built a life. I mean, we have one case in the book of a guy who was in prison more than 35 years. They're heartbreaking. And, yeah, I mean, is it as heartbreaking as somebody who's going to be wrongfully executed? Well, I mean, it's pretty heartbreaking because in this case, you can actually talk to them after they've been exonerated. You can meet the people and understand what they suffered.
Exactly.
We'll never know some of the people who had been executed, whether they were truly innocent or not.
Sadly true. You mentioned earlier that while it was hard to talk about each case in the air, that there were certain common factors that could be found in many of these cases.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us a sense of what some of those common factors are?
Well, for one thing, in almost every case, the person's innocence has played against them. These are mostly very naive people. Hmm. In many cases, they've had no previous contact with the justice system. They may have a family member or somebody like that who's been arrested before or whatever, but they're young, they haven't been in the system. They're not hardened criminals. And that very innocence played against them. They trusted the justice system.
Uh-huh.
They thought that being forthright, cooperating would work. They fully expected to be found innocent at trial. And, of course, they had no idea what the experience of being in prison would be like. So that is common to almost all of them. They are badly injured by their own innocence. And the other factor that's common is, you know, although we have some cases in the book of what I would describe as evil people, prosecutors who made really bad decisions.
We're speaking with Les Klinger, who co-edited the book Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. What an extraordinary idea it was to link up the exonerees with people like Lee Child, Sarah Paretsky, Scott Turow, you know, these famous crime writers.
Yes.
How's the book doing, Les?
Well, it's doing reasonably well. This is I should point out that I shamelessly flog this book because the proceeds are going to Life After Innocence. This is a nonprofit project. And it's, you know, anthologies are a tough sell, but we've been talking about it a lot of places, and the publisher is very pleased with it. So it's doing well.
I wanted to ask you about the letter from playwright Arthur Miller.
Yes.
It's believed to be the first and only unpublished piece since his death. How did it surface?
Well, apparently he gave it at the time to a fellow who is the director of the Northwestern University Innocence Project, and he told him, you know, Miller was obviously involved in the Riley case. He wrote this essay. It wasn't published. He gave it to Rob and said, use it how you see fit. And it sort of sat in a drawer for a long time. Rob is a friend of Laura Caldwell's. They were talking about the book, and he said, well, I have this piece by Arthur Miller. And the estate said, by all means, use it. And so that's how it came to be.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Choice find.
Yeah. Luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Which unfortunately plays into so many of the outcomes of these cases.
Yes. Absolutely. I want to say a word or two about the contributors, the mystery writers, thrillers who took part. First of all, I mean, we're extremely grateful. That goes without saying. But they are grateful. They have become passionate advocates on this subject now. In many cases, they've bonded with the exonerees they worked with. Lee Child and Kirk Bloodsworth, for example, have now appeared publicly several times. Lee calls this the most important thing he ever wrote. And we're so touched by the depth that these people have felt the project. As you mentioned before, this is a work of passion for a lot of individuals. And our hope is that the book will expose this to a much wider audience, that they'll be drawn in by the names of the writers, and people will become aware of the problem. Right now, it's been a, sort of a dirty little secret of the justice system that there are innocent people in jail.
I think this is a brilliant idea.
95% belong there. 95% of the people in prison, you know, under our laws, are guilty and should be incarcerated. Whole separate question, whether the mass incarcerations caused by our system. I mean, we lead the world in prison population and in percentage of prison populations and so on. Why? Is this really what America stands for?
You mentioned a few minutes ago that compilations in general are hard to sell. But what's special about this is the 15 different stories. It actually does what helps reverse what contributes to mass incarceration, which is to humanize and show individual stories. So to me, it seems...
Thank you for saying that.
Yes.
That's exactly
yes.
what we were aiming for.
And because that's by keeping these people anonymous, no one... It's sort of like keeping war photos out of the newspaper. People don't see the horrors. But this, to me, would be wonderful because you can pick it up. It's almost like a short story. Read one now, read another later.
Emotionally, it's hard to read more than one at a time.
Right, right, exactly. Are you speaking across the country with the contributors, I'm sure, are?
Yes. Laura just was at the National Press Club in Washington. We have events coming up in Los Angeles and San Diego in a couple weeks. Then we're in Denver. We're in San Francisco at the Public Library. We've already done a couple of appearances in Chicago and New York. So we're trying to spread the word.
If listeners want to see if there are events in their area, because we go out at over 100 stations, is there a website?
Sure. There is. It's anatomyofinnocence.com. We keep a calendar of the upcoming events on there, as well as press materials and the like.
Wonderful. We'll post that on our website, a link to that.
Thank you.
Les, it's been a real honor to have you on.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your work, really. This
is
brilliant.
You guys are doing great work, too. And you know, we all need to keep our shoulders together on this.
I have to ask you one parting question I can't resist. If Sherlock were with us, and if he were involved in investigating a wrongful case of someone headed to death row, do you think he would relish the challenge?
Absolutely. I mean, we all know the defining characteristic of Sherlock Holmes is that he doesn't work for the government. He doesn't work for the police. He's worked for justice. This is a man who was always driven by justice, and he'd be appalled at some of these cases. And, of course, he was called in many cases of people who turned out to be innocent.
Absolutely.
So.
Well, Les, thanks again, and we look forward to having this book do just wonderfully.
Thank you so much.
Les Klinger is the co-editor of Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. Thanks, Les.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.